Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Thursday, the 18th of April. I'm Louise Herity and here's just some of what's coming up.
Well, unfortunately, there's no magic bullet and I think it would be great if we could say, eat this food and it will improve your arthritis or avoid this food and it will also help.
I'm giving back what I got all them years ago. When I started my time, the average age was a lot older than what it is now. So basically I was working with probably 20 fathers.
But now, parents, what Minister Humphreys, what I was able to explain to Minister Humphreys was that we love talking about our children. We don't want to hide them. We want to celebrate them. And this will enable us to do that. And when the legislation changes, societal attitudes also will change.
Well, there have been many claims about the influence of dietary habits on the symptoms of arthritis, from giving up certain vegetables to adding in particular supplements. But does any of it work? Louise Reynolds, dietitian with the Irish Nutrition and Dietetic Institute, joined Claire Byrne to discuss.
Good morning, Claire. So, nice to talk to you.
And you, and people who are dealing with arthritis, with the pain, the stiffness, the swelling, you're probably going to try anything to relieve those symptoms. But what is the evidence around diet and arthritis and the link between the two?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, there's no magic bullet. And I think it would be great if we could say, eat this food and it will improve your arthritis or avoid this food and it will also help. So it's just very difficult. And also there are so many different types of arthritis and there's not one size will fit all. So people will have to kind of play around a bit. But we do know that what you eat can help and by making small changes. And for each person, it will be different. This week is National Arthritis Week. So that's why we're kind of busting myths around, you know, arthritis, because there's a lot of misinformation. The first thing would be, you know, for osteoarthritis, that it is associated with weight, and if people are carrying extra weight, by losing some weight, that will definitely help. But of course, not everybody with arthritis is living with overweight. So it's, you know, rheumatoid arthritis is more inflammatory, psoriatic arthritis, so many different types of arthritis. And I think the first thing is that people really need to look at their overall diet, back to the kind of things we're always talking about. You know, lots of fruit and vegetables, they contain antioxidants that can help. Looking after your bone health, because obviously your bones in arthritis are also under pressure. Very often they can be affected by medications. So there's so much in it, really. But I think, you know, the first thing is if somebody has osteoarthritis, we do know that weight loss can help to reduce pain if you're living with overweight. So that's the first thing, kind of have a look at the healthy eating guidelines. And that would be, you know, eating more fiber, eating more vegetables, and cutting back on the kind of very sugary processed foods. Mm-hmm. It's easier said than done, though, Claire. We know that as well. You know, it's not straightforward. And of course, people with arthritis might find it more difficult to exercise at times, even though we know exercise is really, really beneficial. So it can be a little bit of a catch-22 for people.
Okay, but that's the general advice across the board, is to try and eat healthily and reduce your weight if you can. But are there certain styles of diets, Louise, that might be better than others?
Yeah, the Mediterranean type diet, there is a lot of research that has gone into that particular type of diet. And again, it's often called a low inflammation diet. And that kind of appeals to people. They're thinking, well, maybe that will help my arthritis. And the key thing in there would be the healthy fats. So we're talking about the kind of olive oil, so the monounsaturated fats, avocados, those kind of foods, they would be have been shown to be more beneficial than a diet which would be higher in saturated fat. And also fish. Now, we know, you know, we've often spoken, Claire, about the benefits of fish oils in the diet, but they do seem to be, and there is good research that has shown they can help some people with arthritis by reducing general inflammation. They may even reduce the duration of morning stiffness. Some people with arthritis can feel very stiff in the morning. So it's a good idea to include oily fish. So the fish we're talking about would be salmon is the most common one people think of. But people might forget about things like mackerel or herring or trout. And you can buy those pre-packaged, you know, kind of a cooked mackerel fillet you can buy in the supermarket. You can add that to a salad, really lovely for lunch with some whole grain bread. Because sometimes people don't want to cook a mackerel. They think it's a lot of work or, you know, it smells out the whole kitchen or, you know, people might think, oh, I don't really like those oily fish. But you can buy even tinned sardines. Really popular, really nutritious.
Yeah,
and an easier way.
Mackerel you're talking about, it's the smoked mackerel, isn't it? You can sort of flake it into a salad and it is lovely.
Exactly. It is lovely. And, you know, you can buy that. It normally comes in a pack of two fillets. And that can be quite expensive, you know, maybe €4, €5. But if they're, you know, that would do you for your lunch for 2 days. Or if there are two people in the house, that would be a nice lunch with, you could make a lovely salad with that. And again, you're getting in lots of colourful vegetables. Again, eat a rainbow. Lots of different colourful vegetables are high in antioxidant vitamins, and they can be really beneficial as well in terms of just kind of getting all of those sort of to look after your cellular health, you know, to look after the cells in our body. They need small amounts of lots of different antioxidants. And that's why when you talk about rainbow of vegetables, each different colour tends to contain a particular type of chemical phytonutrients. So, for example, the purple vegetables are going to be higher in something, and maybe the green vegetables will be higher in something else. So have a look at your plate. You know, anytime you sit down for lunch or dinner, have a look at your plate. If it's very bland looking and very beige, that's a sign, you know, get more colour in there. So whether you're having just carrots and broccoli, or for a snack, including some, you know, kind of colourful fruits and the vegetables as well, is a really good idea.
Listen, I know you prefer people to eat the food rather than take the supplements, but let's take the example of the oily fish. If we have somebody listening to this who has arthritis and just can't bear to eat it, can they take the omega supplement and will that do the same job?
Yes, you can take a supplement. And again, the supplements should contain EPA and DHA. That's the chemical names for what actually the fish oil contains. And between about 500 to 1,000 milligrams, you know, you don't need to take huge amounts. And also, sometimes people with arthritis tend to take lots of different supplements. Now, you need to be careful about that because you could be doubling up on something. And it's not a case of the more, the better. You know, there is a limit to how much of these supplements we should be taking. And also, they can interact with medication. So I think it's important that when you're going to see your doctor, that you do bring along whatever supplements you're on and make sure that, you know, have a little look at the labels, that you're not doubling up. The other source of omega-3s would be the plant-based sources. So things like chia seeds, again, kind of a relatively new food, but quite popular, or flaxseed and linseed. They're the same thing, actually. I think linseed is kind of the older name for it, but flaxseed, they're high in omega-3s, the plant-based sources. So if you like to sprinkle those seeds onto a yogurt or onto your breakfast cereal or a salad, they're really, really nutritious. And I think that's a good idea for people to have. They're also high in lots of other trace minerals and vitamins as well. Mm-hmm. So seeds are a great idea. To include as well. And if you're including them, introduce them slowly at first because they can have impact on your gut. And also some people with arthritis, some of the medications can cause gut problems, and also they may have other kind of other conditions going on as well. So just introduce those foods slowly, but they can be really beneficial and a good way to get the omega-3s as well.
You and I were talking on the programme about intermittent fasting. That, you know, I think you came to the conclusion that it is a good method for some people, but it doesn't have any magical powers. Well, John says that he started intermittent fasting 2 months ago and now has no pain whatsoever from his osteoarthritis. Works for some people.
Yes, and maybe he's lost some weight, which, you know, would certainly help as well. And we did talk about with the intermittent fasting that it's because you've got a smaller window to eat, so you're not maybe doing the snacking on the sugary, you know, or the savoury foods late at night or whatever. But look, that's the thing about arthritis. Maybe people should keep a food diary. Can be a good thing as well, because, you know, something might work for somebody and not work for someone else. And if you do make a change and you see a benefit, stick with it. Once you're not cutting out a whole food group, you know, if you're just cutting out one or two foods and it worked for you, that's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes keeping a food diary in the kitchen and jotting down what you've eaten, and then you can say, oh, well, I feel better now. Or if you're trying a new supplement, try it maybe for a month. If you don't notice any difference, you know, if it's something that's supposed to cause, you know, improvement, then you can stop taking it. So don't feel you have to stick with something. But just do check. If you want to check with a registered dietitian, again, we've spoken about that before, make sure you go to see somebody who's qualified. I'm also doing for National Arthritis Week, I have a webinar today, Claire, to talk more about this at 12:30, actually, in half an hour, if anybody wants to register on the Arthritis Ireland website, they can, because we'll kind of talk a bit about more about this. But it can be daunting for people, and it can be a shock diagnosis, and the pain and the flare-ups can be difficult for people as well. Another tip would be, if you have a flare-up, you're not going to be chopping vegetables. And so frozen vegetables are really handy to have on standby. and you can add those into foods that you're cooking. But, you know, the flare-ups can be very difficult for people, particularly if their hands are involved.
OK, well, that's a good idea, you know, to have the chopped vegetables on standby.
That was Louise Reynolds, dietitian with the Irish Nutrition and Dietetic Institute, on Today with Claire Byrne. On Morning Ireland, Nina Doyle from Féileachán, the stillbirth and neonatal death support charity, joined Áine Lawler to talk about a new public register of stillbirths. And this is part of an overhaul of the registration of births and deaths.
And you haven't just brought yourself, Nina. You've brought a beautiful little teddy that's on the table in front of you. A little teddy that has a pink ribbon and a blue ribbon. And those are for your own twins, Liam and Grace.
That's right. That's right. Thank you very much. Yes, we got this teddy when we knew it was part of the Féileachán memory box we were given when we knew Liam and Grace were coming and that they wouldn't survive. There was two little teddies in that memory box. One went with Liam and Grace and one me and Alan got to keep. And we call it our little Rocky because Liam and Grace were known as Rocky 1 and Rocky 2, our two little fighters. So yeah, Rocky came with me today just
really
to represent them.
You brought him in. Yes.
Thank you very much.
And it was going through that experience, because Liam, he died shortly before birth, and Grace, she died shortly after.
That's
and then
right.
There was a difference in how they were formally recognised. Is that right?
That's right, yes. And I mean, when we were given the certs to register Liam and Grace, we were just so delighted, myself and Alan, to go and register them and to be recognised as their parents. And it was actually a few weeks later that we realised that although we got to recognise them, Liam was given a stillbirth cert, and that is put on the stillbirth register, which is private. Whereas Grace took a breath, she lived for 31 minutes, so she was given a birth and death cert. So in generations to come, Grace would be fully traceable. But because Liam was stillborn, he would be private, which would mean that although they were twins, it would look like myself and Alan only had one child, Grace.
Because we have had registration of stillbirth for the past 30 years. We're still going to keep that stillbirth register.
Yep.
But now there's going to be a public stillbirth record and you'll be able to put Liam's name on that.
Absolutely, I can't wait. Yes, and I suppose this started with your reporter, Sally Ann. And when we came onto the programme and we spoke about, you know, what we would like to happen, I mentioned that I would love to meet with Minister Humphreys and explain the situation and explain options that we felt were doable. And I was delighted when Minister Humphreys contacted me and invited me in. I got to share Liam and Grace's story with Minister Humphreys and her advisors. And it was really great to be given. Caoimhe's mammy came with me that day. And it was really great that Minister Humphreys listened to us that day. And what they have come up with, I think, is something that will represent all parents, because it gives us a choice. It means that the stillbirth register will remain private. When it was brought in 30 years ago, it was Mervyn Taylor that brought it in at the time. And it was brought in, it was the first legislation which was retrospective. So it gave parents the opportunity to register their babies. And they were guaranteed privacy at that time. So this will mean that that privacy is respected, but people are given the opportunity now to make it public.
And this is part of a shift, isn't there, in attitudes that's been happening around stillbirth and miscarriage. You know, before it was something quiet, something private, you know, but now parents are owning their experience. You know, I know there's been miscarriage legislation passed in the Dáil. It's not enacted there yet. How important is it for parents like yourself that your children, even though their time with you was so very, very short, that they are officially recognised by this state? Why is that so important?
Oh, it's hugely important. It's hugely important because in the past there was taboo, there was stigma. It was, and when there's a register that's hidden, it implies that your babies shouldn't be spoken about, and there's a societal, you know, impact on that. Mm-hmm. But now, parents, what I was able to explain to Minister Humphreys was that we love talking about our children. We don't want to hide them. We want to celebrate them. And this will enable us to do that. And when the legislation changes, societal attitudes also will change.
It's a marvellous story. But other changes and other supports that parents dealing with miscarriage, what's the difference, by the way, between, I mean, what are, What, miscarriage was what the legislation was up to 28 weeks. What's officially a stillbirth as opposed to a miscarriage?
Okay, so stillbirth is a death that happens before 24 weeks unless the baby is more than 500 grams. So that's what would have happened in Liam's case. Liam was born at 23 weeks, but he was more than 500 grams. He was 560 grams of perfection. But now what Minister Humphreys is bringing in, she's lowering that threshold to 400 grams. And, you know, that brings so many babies in. I'm thinking of Stephen, who was part of that report at the time, and he will now be recognised. So there's so many babies now that will meet the criteria. And criteria sounds like quite a hard word, but the criteria is now lessening to 400 grams, and babies born that don't meet that criteria, sadly, are classed as a miscarriage.
And I know, unfortunately, your twins didn't make it. But the fact is, modern medicine is now able to do so much for premature babies, so much for babies, you know, at 22, 23
Absolutely.
Weeks that previously would not have had a chance of life?
Yes, and that's why it's changing to 400 grams, you know, and it brings in so many babies. And, you know, we will always, you know, want the legislation to reflect the advances that are happening. Yeah.
And of course, when you have very tiny babies like that, it's hard to hold them in your full arm. You've got to hold them in your hand and put them on your shoulder like that.
It was so lovely to have Liam and Grace on my chest. You know, they spent their whole time. Grace spent 31 minutes she was here lying on my chest. And it was just such a lovely feeling right beside her big brother. And now they will both be recognised equally.
Nina Doyle, Regional Coordinator with Felacon, chatting with Áine Lawler on Morning Ireland. The CSO data for the year until February shows house prices rose by 6.1% across the country. Today's Irish Independent reported one reason for property prices picking up is that buyers believe that interest rates have peaked and will start to come down soon. Charlie Weston, personal finance editor with the Irish Independent, had the story and he joined Claire Byrne.
Good morning, Claire.
So we know, don't we, that interest rates are coming down because the ECB has indicated that they will start to fall in June. So are you saying that there are buyers out there who are watching this and saying, put the bid in now because it's going to be cheaper to borrow?
Well, exactly. It's a complex combination of factors, and it's a difficult decision for people, but they've probably decided interest rates have peaked now, Claire. The strong indications, as you say, are that we'll have a cut in European Central Bank rates in June. Indeed, our own Central Bank Governor, Gabriel McLouf, was saying as much in the last 2 days. He's one of the decision makers on this. And already we have seen AIB and its subsidiaries, EBS and Haven, reducing their green rates. We saw Permanent TSB, or PTSB as it's called now, cut one of its rates recently, and Bank of Ireland introducing a new suite of discounts for people as long as they have some form of energy rating. So we're already seeing mortgage rates soften. So if you're sitting on the sidelines, you're probably saying to yourself, there's a lot of talk about increased supply. It's just not happening. Interest rates are coming down. We best not wait any longer. It's probably best to get in now. The other problem, I suppose, as well, pushing up demand is there's the supply is just not there. And, you know, you have 48% of the houses at the moment that are being bought by what's called non-household purchasers, as the Central Statistics Office calls them. You know, a breakdown of yesterday's figures from Goodbody shows that 48% of purchases are by the likes of housing agencies, you know, approved housing bodies, the land development agency, and investors. So you're competing there in every form. Plus, you know, the number of second-hand houses being put up for sale is at an all-time low. And then if you're a buyer, you have these state schemes, the shared equity scheme, first home, you know, which you can combine with the help to buy if you're a first-time buyer. That could provide you with up to 100,000 euros of buying firepower, if you like. So, I mean, there's really strong demand there, you know, and never mind the demographics, the fact that young people need to form households. So, and the supply just isn't there, and doesn't seem to be a prospect of it. So one of the reasons cited by economist Austin Hughes to me yesterday was, look, at people have decided interest rates have peaked. They're probably going to come down. There's no use hanging back here. We need to get in here because, you know, whatever chance we have, it's not going to get any easier to buy.
But ultimately, this is all about supply, isn't it, really? I mean, this is why the market has continued to be so hot over recent years.
Yeah, and it's getting hotter. For the last 6 months now, we've seen increases. February's increase was the sixth in a row, Claire, and the rate of increase is picking up as well. 6.1% increase annually is quite a very strong increase. I mean, you know, at the end of last year, we had increases of between 1% and 2% in property prices, but now it's up to 6%. So, you just wonder, you know, there is an increased supply of housing, maybe 33,000 units this year. It's just not going to be enough. It's just simply not enough. And if there's so few second-hand houses coming on the market, and if you have approved housing bodies snapping up, you know, huge numbers of new properties, it's just very, very difficult. So, you know, I don't think you need a crystal ball to surmise and conclude that we probably will see prices increasing for a while yet, despite the fact that, you know, transaction levels are down, affordability is an enormous issue for people. Prices are probably just going to keep going for a while yet. That's not great for first-time buyers.
And Charlie, you've been taking a closer look at those CSO figures. What's the regional picture when it comes to house prices? Because the increase is stronger, isn't it, outside of Dublin?
Yeah, and I mean, that's a phenomenon we've seen for a while where people are deciding, you know, I can get better value outside of Dublin. I can probably work from home, get the train once, twice a week, and we can buy, you know, a bigger property than we have in Dublin. You're getting people selling up in cities as well and moving to the regional areas. So, you know, you are seeing big increases outside of the city. You know, the median price for a home, in other words, the typical price, is around 330,000 euros, according to the Central Statistics Office. And, you know, and that can vary hugely then. The median price goes down as low as 135,000 in Castlereagh and Roscommon. So, you know, that you are seeing strong regional increases because there's better value and people can probably work from home and go back to where they grew up. So that's been something that's there for a while. But, you know, the problem is that anything new that's been built, it's been built in the kind of commuter area. So you're not seeing any house building in some counties. So speak to any estate agent, and, you know, I was speaking to some yesterday, and, you know, they put any property anywhere up for sale, and there's a queue of people wanting to see it immediately, and it sells rapidly. So it's a very acute problem, and it doesn't seem to be easing in any way.
And just going back to this assertion, Austin Hughes agreeing with the assertion that it is the prospect of interest rates coming down that might be pushing people out there into the market, or they might be brave enough to dip a toe in the water now. But there are still restrictions on how much they can borrow. Availability will also restrict them. The price of the house will also restrict them. So are we expecting to see down the line more growth, more unprecedented growth in house prices because all of those factors will still be holding prices back?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, we've had some reports that it really is the market's been driven by professional people, high earners, you know, whereas middle-income people are being left out. But you're absolutely right. There's still restrictions on what you can borrow, you know, in terms of your income four times for first-time buyers. You need to have a deposit of at least 10%. So those restrictions are still there. So if you can get over those hurdles, you need to have a very big a combination of a couple for a start. You need to be a couple, and you need to have very decent incomes. And so, you know, this is why we're seeing the most of those buying are lucky enough to get a gift of money from their parents or an inheritance, or else they're on very good big salaries working for a multinational. So, you know, that's what's driving the market at the moment, and that's there and it's going to stay there. So, you know, there's going to continue to be fierce demand, really strong demand for housing in a market that just can't supply enough houses quickly enough.
And you had that confirmed to you as well by an auctioneer who saying, still unsurprisingly, you put a house up on the market and the interest levels are phenomenal.
Phenomenal. It's just that they're besieged by people as soon as they put something up on the market. I mean, I was talking to Robert Gardner of the fixed fee agency auctioneer.ie, and they're just saying, look, did we list something? It's very high levels of demand from buyers straight away. Viewing tenancies are huge. You know, and you can see all this in the record mortgage approvals. The banks are putting out record mortgage approvals. So people are coming along equipped with mortgage approval from probably one or two lenders, and you know, and trying to bid and get in there, but are competing heavily with other buyers. and state-backed borrowers as well.
That was Charlie Weston, personal finance editor with the Irish Independent, on Today with Claire Byrne. On Wednesday night's Arena with Sean Rocks, the host was joined by Arlene Hunt and Mary McGill for some TV reviews. And one of their picks, true crime documentary The Jinx Part 2, is out next Monday.
Now, let us move on to our final one for this evening, which is a true life tale. The Jinx, the life and deaths of Robert Durst. I mean, The Jinx itself, Arlene, the original...
2015. Yeah. Oh, my God. The water cooler moment.
Yeah, at 10 years almost ago at this age. This was a defining moment in terms of true life drama,
this
or true
incredible.
Crime drama.
This is incredible. This is about an obscenely wealthy real estate mogul called Robert Durst, who sat down in 2013 is when he sat down to talk to a director named Andrew Jarecki to speak about... He'd been caught... He had... dismembered his neighbour, this poor man called Morris, I think it's Morris Black was his name.
Mm, I think you're right, yes.
And he had been caught for it and he had gone to court and been exonerated. He was acquitted.
Yeah.
Maybe exonerated is the wrong word, he was acquitted. And so he sat down to have a conversation with this man and about his life, and it turns out that his wife has been missing since 1982, and so too, and his best friend Susan Bergman was murdered in 1982. And so he sat down to chat with them. There was six episodes over the series, and in the last episode he revealed something very powerful about himself.
Yeah, and in fact, as had happened, and I don't think we're giving any spoilers away here because it's so long ago and it was all over the news at the time, Mary, he was arrested before the broadcast of the final episode in season one.
Yes, it gives a whole new meaning to the word hot mic moment, I will say. I had not seen the first episode or the first series
season,
and my jaw was season exactly. My jaw was on the floor. So many true crime formats, dramas, call them whatever you will, make a nod to they're doing what they're doing to kind of bring justice to the situation, often because they know what the material they're dealing with is quite prurient and their role in it is all a bit grubby. Here we have a situation where a documentary team have actually paved the way for justice for the victims of Robert Durst. I just was blown away. I was blown away by him as someone who had, from his earliest years, even as a child, displayed symptoms of some kind of personality disorder. Something wasn't right. His treatment of his first wife, who disappeared in suspicious circumstances, was very troubling, but the authorities couldn't get him because there was no body. There still is no body. And we have the very strange death of his friend, Susan Berman, and we have his neighbour, Morris Black, who he literally, you know, admitted to dismembering. And every step of the way, he got away with it. But in series two, we are now dealing with a Bob, as he likes to call himself, who is in jail, who is going to have to face up to everything that he's done. But I think what series two... It kind of pans out a bit and it goes, how did he get away with this for so long? And central to that are kind of looking at people who, for very kind of weak and self-serving reasons, enabled him to get away with it for as long as he did. It is just, honestly, you could not write drama like this. You couldn't make it up.
Stranger than fiction, as they say, the truth always is. Let's have a listen to a clip featuring Charles Bagley, a New York Times journalist who spoke to Durst after each episode of season one. But here he's just talking about how Durst could call on his old friends after he was arrested.
From the moment Bob was arrested in New Orleans, he was reaching out to old friends, looking to see who can he rely on. He was seeking both emotional support and to see who would be on his side.
Hey, dog.
Hey, how you doing? Hello, Bobby.
Hi, Sue.
Susie?
How are you?
The people around Bob helped him, whether it was consciously or unconsciously, go on for so many years without consequence.
And I wanted you to know, I would have taken care of anything you needed taken care of. You know that.
I know that.
I like to think that if a good friend of mine is suddenly implicated in one, two, three murders, that I would recoil from that. But who knows until you're tested?
That's Charles Bagley, the New York Times journalist, in a scene from The Jinx season two. And Arlene, we were talking about the fact one of the people that befriended Durst after his acquittal in the murder trial of Maurice Black was one of the jurors.
That's right.
He seemed to just have this charisma that, well, maybe it's money that he has. He could, anybody would do anything for him.
That's Chris Lovell and his wife Donna. Donna became the assistant to Bob Durst, and Bob Duvall was her husband and a great friend of Durst's as well, which developed after the trial. But I mean, he's surrounded by a cast of lunatics, is basically, and they operated like the mafia. As long as the money is coming in and they're getting their slices of the pie, they don't really care. There's nothing about these people that it has
any sort of
moral compass whatsoever. And there's a huge cast. There's a guy here called Nick Chinga-Chavin, could only be an American. He's a real estate developer, a country and western porn singer.
I don't know if that's a specific type of porn singer, but anyway, let's go on.
He's a country and western porn. That's what he is. That's his part-time
job.
But he's a really interesting character because he was a friend of Katie, who was Bob Durst's first wife. He was a good friend of Susan Bergman.
All right.
And he knew that it was most likely that Bob had killed both of those women, and he didn't really mind because he liked Bob. And it wasn't, he didn't feel suitably motivated to maybe talk to the police about him until his second wife sort of gave him a guilt trip about it. That's what you're dealing with.
You two, I have to say, I have had a great week at the television. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, I had three. I'm absolutely hooked on all three of these items that we've dealt with this evening. Stars from you, Arlene, on The Jinx Part 2.
I'm actually just going to go ahead and give it a 5 because I find this entire concept of this show fascinating. Right. And the more I learn about this man, the more horrified I am to.
And from you, Mary?
Yeah, it's a good 4 from me. I mean, my jaw was on the floor. I hadn't heard about The Jinx. I was like, what is The Jinx? And I mean, there's a scene, if you haven't watched the first episode, there's a scene in the first series of the second, or the first, if you haven't watched the first series, the first episode of the series 2, there's a scene in that will literally, it's like nothing I have ever seen before. Yeah, it's a piece of filmmaking that just goes spectacularly well.
It's extraordinary stuff. Yeah, yes. People watching season 1.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, very solid from both of you there on The Jinx Part 2, set to premiere on Sky Documentaries. That's next Monday the 22nd.
Oh, I can't wait for it myself. Arlene Hunt and Mary McGill reviewing the second season of The Jinx on Arena with Sean Rocks. A 4-year-old girl from County Down is recovering after undergoing complex brain surgery in Ukraine. Rachel Gribben suffers from a severe form of epilepsy, which led to multiple seizures and serious developmental issues. The local community in Killyleagh helped raise the funds for her surgery in Ukraine, and her mum, Katie, spoke to Brian Dobson on the News at One and told him how Rachel ended up having her operation in Ukraine.
She was referred to Manchester Children's Hospital and Older Hay. They have a combined team of neurosurgeons because we don't have neurosurgery in Northern Ireland. So there's no neurosurgery here. So she was referred to the team there. She was meant to have had some tests, you know, pretty much straight away to see if she was a candidate for surgery. Unfortunately, once she had these tests, they came to the conclusion that she wasn't a candidate for surgery. Now, me being stubborn, received the news that she wasn't a candidate for surgery and that it was just going to be medication and possibly a device called a VNS. I decided that I wasn't willing to accept that. I'd done lots of research. I joined lots of different forums on Facebook and support groups and pediatric epilepsy surgery. A name kept on coming up, Dr. Luke Tmyach from New Jersey. Now, he's the director of the Epilepsy Institute there. And I thought to myself, well, who better than someone that runs a hospital dedicated to epilepsy? So I got in touch with him and he got back in touch with me straight away. And we discussed Rachel's case, had a couple of Zoom meetings, he was pretty confident that he could do something for Rachel down, you know, the surgery route and try and give her some seizure freedom. Mm. The only option thing with that is that going to America was going to be at least £100,000 minimum.
Mm.
And that was something we're never going to be able to do, even with fundraising, you know. It's an awful lot of money. But then he notified me that he actually goes to Ukraine, to Lviv, every year, works with their neurosurgeons, treating epilepsy, bringing on, you know, their technology there. He's a big advocate for epilepsy surgery, which is something that's really underutilized across the world.
So Ukraine then became an option, but I presume you had a lot of questions about how safe it would be traveling to a country that's at war.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when he first said traveling to Ukraine, I must admit, I kind of laughed at him. And then, you know, he was reassuring me that Lviv was perfectly safe. And, you know, he said, you know, I mean, his words were everybody's going about their daily business. Mm-hmm. That he's traveling there with his own family.
So you were
every year, and
you were reassured, obviously.
Yeah, he
by
really
that.
Reassured. Yeah. Really reassured. This.
But you still found yourself, I think, on one occasion, taking shelter in the bomb shelter under the hospital.
Yes. So the air raid sirens were pretty much daily. First time we arrived in Ukraine on the 19th of March. She started testing straight away that evening, and then on Friday night we were awoken in the middle of the night sirens and were moved to a corridor in the middle of the hospital away from windows and such, with the possibility of being moved to the bunker, which was the basement floor of the hospital. Being down there was very, very daunting. I had seen all the beds and everything lined up against the corridors and everything down there ready, and then even being moved to, you know, what they call the safe zone before needing to be moved to the actual bunker. It was just so, at first, very, very scary, you know, hearing those sirens, thinking, oh my gosh, what's happening? This is the first time we've heard sirens, and it was horrifying.
Well, obviously you're concerned for Rachel, concerned about the surgery and also facing this situation as well. But the surgery did go ahead, Katie, and it's been a success.
It's been a fabulous success, an absolute fabulous success. She's 4 weeks on Friday post-op and 4 weeks seizure-free. So it's a massive, massive success. And to think that war-torn Ukraine had time to treat a little girl from Kitty Lay, it's just amazing.
Katie Jennings, mother of 4-year-old Rachel, who's recovering well from her surgery, talking to Brian Dobson on the News at One. On the Oliver Callan Show, Conor Doolin, head of apprenticeships at Irish Rail, joined the presenter to talk about careers with the company. Conor himself started as an apprentice 25 years ago.
Now I look after apprentices, so I suppose I'm giving back what I got all them years ago. When I started my time, the average age was a lot older than what it is now. So basically I was working with probably 20 fathers. They were way older than me. So when we came in, there was two or three of us came in as apprentices. Like, you know, the nearest person to us could be well in their 50s. So there was a huge age gap. And I'll never forget one of the gentlemen I worked with. You know, they all mightn't have been as enthusiastic as me, the new recruits. So I was mad eager to get going. And, you know, my father had me well warned. When you go in there now, he says, you want to work. And if they ask you to sweep the floor, you sweep the floor. No matter what they are, you're there to work. And I says, yeah. But there was some people that mightn't have had the same fire in their belly as me. But the elderly gentleman said to him, he says, come here, you. He says, he says, you know, you're here to serve your time and not waste your time. So they were giving out to other people, but so to seeing the potential in people.
The unofficial slogan.
Yeah.
Well, it worked out
tough
well.
Tough love.
Yeah. It worked out well, showing that you had the enthusiasm. So you're now in charge of the apprentices. What has it been like then in recent years in terms of the intake of apprentices?
So I took over this role in late 2021. And, you know, I seen it from both sides of the coin. I seen it from an apprentice point of view. I said I was treated so well as an apprentice. I met some fantastic people. Some people seeing potential in me. They helped me along, and no doubt I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for those people. They were just fantastic role models. They were like father figures. So that's my chance now to give back. And I want to become that father figure for students and for apprentices.
Very good.
And I can see I am making an impact. I am making a change. And it's for the better.
And you regularly have schools and youth clubs visiting a setup in each corps as well, as part of your role.
Yeah, so as part of, one of the things I seen was that a lot of people were undecided of what they wanted to be, and there was no real place for them to trial this sort of trial or apprenticeship. You know, you just applied and then you got it, and then some people mightn't like it. So I decided to I spoke to the CME and a few different senior managers, and they gave me the go ahead to open up the Inchicore Railway Works for a number of days for an event called Try a Trade, where we sent an email to all the schools and brought in loads of students from different schools all around Ireland to try a trade. So we had all our different trades. So we had the mechanical, we had the electrical, and we had all the different trades that we do.
That you do, very good.
And we brought them in and we gave them a sample of each and showed them a real life example of what you'd be doing. And the uptake was fantastic. Yeah. And again, like the level of interest, it accelerated unreal. And people were, saying this is great, and I'd love to play, I'd love to be this, and I'd love to be that. So seeing is believing. Hands-on is the way forward. If they got to participate and see, it makes a big difference.
Wow, it really opens the eyes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and as I said, we notice, like, the especially females. We got a lot of we targeted a lot of female schools, and when they came, they were like, geez, this is fantastic. You know, I'd love to be a mechanic, or I'd love to be an electrician, and they didn't know what it entailed. But then to see in firsthand, and we had some fantastic people there, my colleagues with me, and we were showing them exactly what it entails, and asking questions and giving them answers and just showing them the ins and outs and giving them a tour around and,
And are we seeing an increase in women taking up the apprenticeships?
Yeah, we are, yeah. So our numbers have grown very big. So we're at 10 now. That's fantastic. When I took over, we only had one.
Wow.
Big improvement. Yeah. But I can see it from going to school. So I go to school career events. I was meant to be one in Cork this morning, thankfully my colleague Tom, I'm sure he's tuned in there. He's taken the reins, so he's gone down with an apprentice down to Cork. And they're going to be, showcasing what apprenticeships we have and talking about apprenticeships and doing different things. So, yeah.
It's going around the country. Yeah.
We go around the country. Yeah. We're invited to these events. Yeah.
So this is, you're looking for an intake. This will be in September, I presume.
So September intake. Yes. Yeah. The campaign is actually going live today. The recruitment is going live today at 12 o'clock, I believe.
Oh, brilliant.
Perfect timing for this event. Yeah.
Siobhan is already on to us going, can you talk about the range of apprenticeships available?
So basically what we have, we offer four apprenticeships. We offer a mechanical maintenance fitter, a heavy vehicle mechanic, electrician, and the new apprenticeship, which is an OEM technician. So it's mechanical and electrical engineering technician apprenticeship. It's a 3-year program.
The OEM?
Yeah, the OEM.
Oh, yeah, that's a new one.
Original equipment manufacturer, yeah. So it's run by Monaghan and Limerick. They're the two colleges that run this.
Not many trains in Monaghan?
Not many trains in Monaghan, no. But Limerick, we have a good few down in Limerick.
Do, yeah,
so
yeah.
We make up for it there. But they run a fantastic. Anne-Marie is the coordinator of the apprenticeship, the OEM apprenticeship. And it's a really, really good program. And we have 9 students on it at the minute. And they're doing really well. It seems to be a very popular choice now.
To get that 9, would there have been a huge number of applications?
Last year was the highest. We had the highest number of applicants. We had almost 3,000 applications last year.
Really?
It grew significantly, yeah. That was all with, the networking that's going on, the network we're doing. And we are the elite out there, we have the trophy to prove it.
Yeah.
We won the Apprentice Employer of the Year for 2022,
right,
which was a massive achievement. And then in 2023,
it's very difficult to get into the
For the large business category. So like when you're up again, the elite of the elite, it's a high level. So thankfully we've done very well, and very proud to be part of the program to achieve that, And then in 2023, it's a personal award. It was actually won by myself. It's a Apprentice Advocate for the Outside World. So it's for my contribution towards apprenticeships and encouraging people to join apprenticeships and getting the numbers up and just going to schools and, I suppose, making people aware of apprenticeships. And
congratulations.
Thanks very much.
And so you got the award for being here as well.
Yeah, I got the award for being here as well. Yeah.
Here as well. Are they paid apprenticeships?
They are indeed, yeah. So the saying is, you earn while you learn. So that's one of the good ones. Yeah. So yeah, there's you get paid each year, and it goes up on yearly increments for the 4 year or the 3 years, whichever apprenticeship you decide to take.
Okay, yeah.
So the general apprenticeships, the electrician, the fitter, and the heavy vehicle mechanic, they're 4 year apprenticeships, and then the OEM is 3 year apprenticeship.
Okay. And after the 3 or 4 years, are you more or less guaranteed a job or?
So it depends on the individual. It depends on the business requirements. You know, no one knows what's ahead. But generally speaking, if apprentices are very good and behave themselves, and you know, they're punctual and they're good work ethic, you know, they will be offered a job.
They will.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously you've spent so much money as well.
Yeah, and you've invested time and you've invested money in them. They know the business, and you know, and you'd like to keep them on. But as I said, not everyone is taken on. Not everyone wants to be kept on, but that's an individual choice, you know.
So how do you decide out of the thousands of applications you get? What does it really come down to? Obviously, there must be some positive discrimination towards women, I presume.
So basically what happens is we look through the applications and then what's their an aptitude test then whittles down the numbers. So they go through various different stages of aptitude tests, and that picks the kind of people who are going to go to the next stages, and then obviously to an interview stage, and then the medical stage. So you'd lose a certain percentage at each.
I see what you mean.
Each step, and then you'd interview would be the last step, and then the medical. But yeah, you'd have a good indication by then. You know, the process is there to I suppose pick the best out of the groups.
Very good. Well, I've got some more questions here. At the end of the training period, are they guaranteed job? I've asked that one already. Is there an upper age limit for apprenticeships? Michael wants to know in Dublin 12.
No, there's no upper. We've had apprentices coming in from the very youngest. So the minimum age requirement is 16. We've had adult apprenticeships as well, where we look back through the business and we brought in adult apprenticeships. So we offered people that were already in the company, and we'd give them an opportunity to upskill. Maybe they were a general operative, or they hold a different position in the company and would like to become a tradesperson or a mechanic or a fitter or whatever. And we'd take them on and bring them back and put them through college and school and upskill them to that level.
You're really selling us Irish Rail as a happy place to work.
Yeah, it is a fantastic place to work. I work with some of the best people in the world. My colleagues are great. They're friends. They're not work colleagues. They're friends, and it's just like one big family. But I said it's the effort that goes in daily, involved in the railway. So basically, from the time you get up, like you meet people, and you know, you're chatting to them, and but everyone has a role to do, and everyone tucks in together, and everyone rows in behind one another to get. To do what we have to do, you know. As I said, it's an industry, it's a business, and it needs good people, you know.
It's for all those people, as you said, behind the scenes. Someone's messaging as well, saying they're on the Cork. They were on the Cork to Dublin train a few years ago. Elderly couple got on at Mallow, thinking the train was going to Cork. Staff were very kind and helpful to them, let them off at the next available stop. Made sure someone met them and put them in the correct train. That's from Gabrielle. So that's someone who really appreciates people working behind. This man is brilliant, so enthusiastic, so articulate. I wish him and his crew all the best. And this is away from apprenticeships, but it's a super nerd question. Given your train background, is he intrigued by the steam age, I wonder? They were living, breathing, iconic engineering miracles for me. Each one a work of art in its own way. Does he have any similar fascination with them, I wonder?
So the Railway Preservation Society, so they maintain the steam engine, and the steam engine is still in use today. They actually have a Santy train. And I travelled on the Santy train and I went to Maynooth, but that was the steam engine. So, the kids kids get to...
So it goes out once a year?
It goes out at Christmas time, yeah. And they bring them on different journeys, I suppose, when times are quiet. But yeah, steam engines. Yeah, they're really good to see them. And it says you don't see it that often. No, I wouldn't see it that often. But when you do see it, it's intriguing to see it. But I said it's great for the kids when they go on the Santy train and you see all the steam and puffing away.
John will be delighted now to hear that.
Yeah,
good question, John. In his eyes, the change. Well, we already spoke about that. So how do we apply for the apprenticeships? How do they go about it?
So yeah, so today at midday, the applications will go live. So they just go onto the website, www.irishrail.ie, and then they look for the apprentice application, and then they fill in the application, and it's self-explanatory from there on. They just follow the process.
Conor Doolan, Head of Apprenticeships at Irish Rail, on the Oliver Callan Show. Also on the show, Oliver was talking about the increase in racism and racist attacks in Ireland.
It is happening, and it's happening to our friends who come here from abroad. They're coming for a better life, and they are needed indeed in our roaring economy, because the industries, there are many, many places struggling to fill jobs. But they find themselves living in a different Ireland today than they were in even, I'd say, a year, definitely 2 years ago. And there's a story in the Irish Times today. It's about a Brazilian man who's living a nightmare after a racist attack. Isabella Beauchat is the journalist here. He was seriously assaulted in Limerick Saturday night after being asked where he was from before the attack, which has left him with six stitches above his left eye. Roberto Gomez de Santos, he's 33. He was on his way home along with his brother, and they were both approached by a man on Childers Road in Limerick who questioned their nationalities before using something they say was similar to a baseball bat to hit him in the face. He says, "It all happened very fast. I didn't even have time to defend myself. I have no doubts this was a racist assault, because when the attacker realised we were not from Ireland, he said, OK, and he hit us. I fell straight to the ground. I realised I was covered in blood. It was living in a nightmare." He's originally from a favela in Rio de Janeiro's sprawling suburbs, moved to Limerick 2 years ago to escape the reality of living in Rio because of the high levels of violence there and the presence of multiple crime groups, which he says is very difficult. But he says now he is planning to return to Brazil in September. "I want to go home. I will save money for that. I can't afford to buy the tickets right now because I can barely afford the rent. I will ask my family for help if I need to. But I have a scar now that I will never forget. I've had stones thrown at me before, but nothing as serious as what's happened. It was horrible. I think this needs to be dealt with in a proper way by the authorities. I've been here for 2 years. I've seen an increase in assaults. This is going to explode," he says. And the Brazilian community in Limerick and across the country have been expressing their disgust and distaste on social media. It's become routine, they're saying, assaults against migrants. It's not just Brazilians. This shouldn't be normalised. Another person said, "I was attacked a few times, but thank God nothing as bad as what happened to Roberto. It's so unfortunate. Get well soon. Gardaí say they're investigating." And we reached out to Roberto this morning, and a member of our team was speaking to him. He seems to be doing OK. He's in fact listening to us this morning. So good morning to Roberto. We're thinking about you. And he's in better form. He's recovering from his injuries. He's an appointment at the GP in relation to his teeth, because that's what happens. But he is sure his confidence has been trashed. But we said we'll stay in touch with him. So good morning to you, Roberto. Is there anything we could do for... It's so sad. It's desperately, desperately sad. And there are other stories which I think are worth mentioning again this morning, because as many of you know, there was 100 people attended the vigil in Clondalkin in Dublin only a couple of days ago, close to where Joseph Strock was found on March 30th after he was seriously assaulted. He's a Croatian man, 39 years of age, working here as a carpenter. He lived in Dublin city centre and he suffered serious head injuries. He was on life support for several days, but he was pronounced dead on the 3rd of April. And it's believed he was attacked because he and his friend were speaking Croatian on the streets of Dublin. And his friend said they were told they should speak English when they're in Ireland just before the attack. One of the people at the vigil, she is Croatian, Roberta Terzic. She said, "I have no words to explain. She left Croatia 9 years ago to come and live in Ireland, and she's had a lovely time living here, but she's described the assault and death as devastating. I'm in Dublin since 2015. I've never felt the way I feel now. The scenario has changed the whole perspective about the environment that I live in," adding that she now fears for her safety. "I always felt like I belonged here in Ireland, but now I don't feel like I'm welcome anymore." It's extraordinary. The vigil was organised by members of Clondalkin for All, with a member, Dara Adelaide, describing the assault as disgusting, barbaric, backwards. Clondalkin, he says, has always been a welcoming community. "My father came here from Nigeria 27 years ago. We lived happily here. You see a lot of faces here, people from all sorts of backgrounds. That's what Clondalkin has always been about." But things are just, they're just changing. They're changing. This is a story this morning. As it happens, Michael Verney is writing in the Irish Independent about the Wexford hurler Lee Chin. "It's 12 months since racial abuse was thrown at Lee Chin by an opposition supporter and had forced the abandonment of a charity match against Tipperary in Carrick on Shore. But it's only now that he feels comfortable enough, Lee Chin that is, to talk about the unsavoury racist incident for the first time. Now, Lee Chin is showing extraordinary empathy in this interview because his thoughts are with the man who racially abused him on the day, because that man endured a widespread backlash from the GAA community, as you can imagine. I was quite conscious of him. I genuinely was. Even my family were. This is Lee Chin. We would be that way inclined at home, and we were conscious of his feelings and how things can end up for him. I received an apology from the man himself. We've exchanged phone calls since to talk about it. I remember the phone call I had with him. He was very sorrowful. He couldn't apologise more. We had good conversations. And he said, look, there's a part of me that at the time that felt sorry for him because he's a family of his own and what happened was unfortunate. But sometimes things are said in the heat of the moment that are not meant with great malice. And he was on the end of this racial abuse, and he talks about, obviously it's not something you think about every day, but when it happens, it's disappointing to hear. It's not something I can control. And he's kind of speaking those unspoken things that people who are Irish indeed and who come from a different heritage, they kind of park it away because it's just part of the baggage that they had to carry around with them. And just to round this off, a reminder of that story, which was out yesterday, and it was about drug use, but a survey by SIP2 of their staff on bus and rail and Lewis networks around the country, a survey of 650 workers, SIP2 workers. They said racism is part of the epidemic of abuse and antisocial behaviour that staff are facing in our public transport. More than three quarters of ethnic minority staff reported incidents of racist harassment and abuse while at work. So it is just extraordinary. And when you point out racism like we're doing this morning, there are people sometimes inclined to equate that with a call for open borders. And it's not that. We know we have a housing disaster in this country. Everybody knows that. And it makes our ability to accept more immigration very difficult, including the immigration that we need to staff our industries and so on. And it also makes the arrival of immigrants here seem much more bigger and much more of a crisis than it is compared to other countries. And I mean, the housing disaster is extraordinarily profitable for a very few people. And so instead of channeling the anger into a democratic campaign for policy change or for fairness here, that anger has become a rage online where it's very easily manipulated. And after a few years stewing there, we can hear now the evidence that it's erupting onto our streets and becoming racist violence. And those social media companies, by the way, they're regulated in Ireland on behalf of Europe, but they're not forced to do very much about this. The far right are thriving online. They're not doing enough, the companies, to stop this flood of hatred and incitement. You'll find it in seconds if you go on there right now. And it's not only harming, you know, the people who happen to be immigrants here, it's also turning young Irish men, and they are always, nearly always men, into criminals.
And I'm sure Oliver will continue that conversation tomorrow morning on his show at 9 o'clock. But that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.